Now from the KSFR Newsroom, At Noon looks at the top local news headlines for this Tuesday, October 29th.
Reductions in federal funding are threatening Santa Fe's public transit system. The Journal North reports Santa Fe Trail's fleet of 36 buses is expected to shrink to 23 by 2016 due to annual cuts totaling up to $800,000. The federal legislation that supports the system includes cuts to the funding formula, prompting smaller cities like Santa Fe to weigh future options. Those include extending the operating life of the buses, using bond funding, or buying less expensive buses that have a shorter operating lifespan. From the Four Corners region comes word that the New Mexico Department of Veterans Services wants to create four new small cemeteries to reduce the travel distance for military families. San Juan County boasts a large number of veterans, and the nearest federal cemetery is here in Santa Fe, a distance of some 200 miles. The Farmington Daily Times reports that each cemetery would cost $1.5 million. Plans for the Veterans Services Department to secure 10% of that total cost, $600,000, is seed money. Funding for the cemeteries will require approval by the state legislature. A regional meeting of forensic scientists continues through Wednesday in Santa Fe. Fideli Nathanson, a forensic scientist with the New Mexico Department of Public Safety, says the meeting serves training needs and provides updates on trends and technologies. Nathanson stresses forensic scientists' work is not as seen on TV, but rigorous.
Test unknown substances, test DNA swabs, look at fingerprints without any misleading information or public information from the news. We just have to look at the evidence.
Nathanson also says synthetic pot sold in smoke shops is a serious problem being discussed at the conference. We'll have more about the conference during the feature segment of At Noon in a few minutes from now. New Mexico Public Education Secretary-designate Hannah Scandera will likely get a vote on her confirmation in the upcoming 2014 legislative session. Scandera was named to the post 3 years ago by Governor Martinez. It was just during the last legislative session that lawmakers took up confirmation hearings, only to adjourn without a vote. The New Mexican reports that State Senator Linda Lopez, the chair of the Senate Rules Committee, says a vote will be taken, and if not confirmed, Scandera, quote, is gone that same day, end quote. Ray Sandoval, the campaign manager for Santa Fe mayoral hopeful Romana Beta, says he wants police to investigate an unauthorized posting of his picture in a Craigslist personals ad. The posting was widely circulated by email sent to the Beta campaign and others, as well as to the Kiwanis Club, for whom Sandoval organizes the annual Zozobra burning. Sandoval says the mailing is a political attempt to harm Beta's campaign. The photo in question shows Sandoval in briefs in a non-sexual pose. Sandoval posted it to friends on Facebook 2 years ago while in the midst of an exercise regimen. New Mexico Senator Tom Udall, along with his senator cousin Mark from Colorado, has introduced legislation to establish a national renewable electricity standard. The proposal would require utilities to generate 25% of their power from wind, solar, and other renewable sources by 2025. The Democratic senators say such a move would create jobs, reduce pollution, and save consumers money. New Mexico is one of 29 states that have renewable generation standards with various timelines and targets. The city of Santa Fe has announced that Lena Street is closed between 2nd and Cedevaca due to water leaks. Street repairs are expected to be complete by Friday. Just in time for Halloween, City of Santa Fe water customers are being offered a chance to give their water bill a treat by trading in their old shower head for a new EPA WaterSense environmental low-flow model. The swap, intended to improve water efficiency, will take place from 9 a.m. till 2 p.m. on Thursday, or as long as supplies last, at the City Water Division headquarters on West San Mateo Street. Santa Fe's average daily use is 106 gallons per person per day, which is substantially lower than the national average of about 150 gallons. Weather for Santa Fe, mostly sunny and windy today. Expect highs in the upper 50s. It'll be cloudy tonight with a low of 35 and a 20% chance for showers, possibly mixing with snow after midnight. Still a slight chance for a mix of precipitation early Wednesday before turning sunny by afternoon. Highs tomorrow in the upper 40s. I'm Tom Tropridge, KSFR News.
Support comes from New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, where the more you participate in your not-for-profit financial cooperative, the more money you earn. For details on Earn Your Return, go to nmefcu.org or visit their branch on St. Michael's Drive.
12 minutes past the hour as At Noon continues now with today's feature stories. Borreliosis. That's a fairly rare disease of the respiratory system caused by exposure to the chemical element beryllium. That substance has a number of industrial uses, as it's often used to harden metals. It's also used in the manufacture of nuclear weapons, and thus workers at both the Los Alamos and Sandia National Laboratories are at heightened risk for suffering ill effects of beryllium toxicity. We're joined now by Dr. Lisa Meyer, the chief of the National Jewish Health Division's Environmental and Occupational Health Services. Dr. Meyer, you're in Santa Fe today to discuss detection and treatment of those who have been sickened with beryllium. Tell us more about the illness it can cause.
Interestingly, when beryllium was first used at places like Los Alamos, Oak Ridge, and other parts across the country and internationally, in the manufacture of our first nuclear weapons, we began to note a scarring lung disease in people who were working with this metal. And what we now know is that the body responds, develops an immune response, actually, to beryllium, similar to an allergy, except it's a cell allergy. So you don't get runny nose, itchy eyes, but the cells in a small percentage of people who are exposed to beryllium detect the beryllium, and they see it as a foreign invader, if you will. So they mount this immune response, and then eventually it's almost like a war is going on in the lungs, and they recruit a bunch of other soldiers. They have a number of inflammatory cells end up in the lungs, and they form these clusters of what are called granulomas. And the problem is those clusters of granulomas or white cells can form in the airways. They can form near blood vessels, near the air sacs where, you know, the job of the air sacs is to transfer oxygen. So it can have a significant effect on people's lung function.
And what are some of the symptoms of the disease?
We now know that this disease, as its name indicates, is a chronic disease. And so some people, if we catch them very early on, may have no symptoms related to their disease. Their lungs may be functioning very normally. They may not have any problems with their breathing. However, some folks will actually notice that they have a cough or they'll have some shortness of breath, especially with more significant activities, you know, running, and or they can have sweat at night. And as the disease progresses and gets more severe, then people tend to have more symptoms. So then the shortness of breath may occur with minimal activities or eventually even at rest. The cough can get worse. They can have chest tightness. They may even develop with some problems with the heart because the lung and the heart are closely related and may require oxygen. So it's a real spectrum. But unfortunately, these symptoms aren't different than symptoms that people have with other lung diseases. So they don't help tell us that someone has beryllium disease versus something like asthma or COPD.
How is it diagnosed?
We can catch a precursor to the disease called beryllium sensitization, which is just that allergy, if you will. But we can also detect people who have chronic beryllium disease. And so once somebody has this abnormal blood test, then we usually recommend that they come in, undergo an evaluation with a physician, and that includes biopsy through a bronchoscope, which is a fiber optic tube.
What sort of projects would workers at our national laboratories have been working on that utilized beryllium?
Originally, again, Los Alamos, like our other their sister city, if you will, down in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, were very involved with working on the nuclear bomb. And beryllium has been used in the shell of the nuclear of nuclear weapons. And so most of the people who were exposed were machining beryllium or metal. The other issue, though, is now beryllium is used in a lot of other applications. So it's used in a lot of high-tech applications, for example, telecommunications, radar. It's used in aerospace industries, so helicopters, fighter planes, even some regular airplanes have a little bit of beryllium in them, too. But the issue is it's people who manipulate that beryllium. They do something to it. Beryllium just sitting there doesn't bother anybody. In contrast to a lot of the other nuclear weapons workers who've had radiation exposure from the plutonium or uranium, beryllium is not radioactive. And the issue here is when you manipulate the beryllium or you machine it, you produce very, very small particles, small enough that we can't see them with the naked eye, and they're small enough to be inhaled into the lung, just like a particle that can be in the air around you.
How rare a disease is borreliosis?
We know from studies way back when that it can occur approximately 1%, but potentially up to 10 to 20% of people exposed. So certainly not the majority of those people that work with beryllium. But again, in some workforces, it can be a pretty significant percentage. And what our studies and others have indicated is the higher the exposure, the higher the frequency or percentage of people developing especially chronic beryllium disease and maybe sensitization too.
Anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
There have been some really good efforts in the Department of Energy complex to reduce exposures to beryllium and to make sure that people who are exposed are being monitored for the health effects. And so that is actually even a federal rule. Unfortunately, that's not been the same for industries that aren't associated with the Department of Energy complex, and it's something that we really think is going to be important to ensure that we can reduce the number of people that develop this disease, because again, this is an opportunity for prevention of disease. If we can reduce those exposures, we may not totally eliminate the disease, but I think we can reduce the numbers. So I'd like to see us be able to have an approach that affects all of our workers, whether they're at a place like Los Alamos in Sandia or maybe a mom-and-pop shop where they're smelting metals.
Dr. Lisa Meyer, many thanks for joining us here at noon on KSFR, which will continue in just a moment.
Support comes from Mountain Cloud Zen Center in Santa Fe, where there's no need to don robes or shave heads. The miracle of everyday life. That's where real awakening happens, in the midst of ordinary lives. A taste of the deep, clear peace of authentic Zen can be found at Mountain Cloud Zen Center. Thursday night talks and Sunday morning practice with resident Zen teacher Henry Shookman. Everyone always welcome. Learn more at mountaincloud.org.
20 minutes past the hour as At Noon continues. A newly released report says that New Mexico's child care reimbursement rate is among the lowest in the nation. Here to discuss the report and its implications is Bill Jordan, the Senior Policy Advisor for New Mexico Voices for Children. Bill, tell us about the report and its significance.
Well, every year there's a survey of child care providers and what the reimbursement rates are in various states. And once again, New Mexico reimburses well below the 75th percentile of the average market rate. That's a big way of saying we're not paying enough. You may be aware that last week, Legislative Finance Committee had a study that said that the quality of child care wasn't as good as they had hoped. And, of course, one of the reasons is we're not reimbursing enough. And we're generally talking about young babies, a few months old, up until the time that they would go into kindergarten. So, you know, let me remind everyone that child care really was considered a work support. Back when we did welfare reform in 96, promised parents that if they went to work, we would help them provide a safe place for their kids to go while they were at work. And so we boosted our investment in child care. And since then, we've never kept the promise. We have underfunded it. We have thousands of parents and kids on a waiting list for child care. We have for 3 years now. And it simply isn't fair to those parents to expect them to go to work, but then not to provide some help with child care. You know, people don't realize child care costs more than tuition at the University of New Mexico. And these are kids who can't work their way through. They don't have Pell Grants. They don't have a lottery scholarship. And the parents generally are younger and really not making as much money as they are once their kids are getting into the college years. So it's a huge expense for these young families. And we promised our parents that we would provide some help with child care assistance, and we're not providing enough. We have a waiting list that's too large, and for those that are not on the waiting list and lucky enough to get some assistance, the reimbursement rates are low, and therefore the quality is not that good.
What's the connection between the reimbursement for child care and future school performance?
Well, I think the easiest way to say it is you get what you pay for. If we're paying very low reimbursement rates, child care centers are not able to provide the kind of quality care. That means that they can't hire qualified staff. It means that the ratio of teachers to children is way too high and that the children don't get as much personal attention. So there's a direct relationship between what we pay and the kind of quality education or care that our children get.
Should we conclude that with lower reimbursement rates, there's an increased likelihood a child won't get adequate nutrition, stimulation, or socialization?
That's right. What we don't want is that situation where the folks next door have 8 kids sitting in strapped into seats, propped in front of a television all day. And I should be fair, that's not happening very often. It does happen, but for the most part, our child care providers are doing the best that they can, and many of them are highly skilled and providing really excellent care and really helping to prepare the kids to go to school ready to learn. The lower quality child care is not able to provide that. So we need to do better by our kids. We need to keep the promise to parents and our children, improve the quality, and the only way to really do that is to increase the reimbursement.
What happened to the funds that were supposed to be available?
You know, it's really sad. In 2001, we were helping people with their child care at a level of double the poverty rate, so 200% of the federal poverty rate, still defined as what we would call low-income families. And a couple of years later, we cut the money. When we hit this latest recession, we had to start a waiting list again. And it has never been a priority of either the governor or the legislature to fully fund child care, to end the waiting list, and to improve the quality. And so that's where we are. We're just not investing enough money in it.
And what's your position on what can be done to remedy the situation?
You know, what we now know is that early brain development is crucial to a child's success. All the science tells us those first few years are critical to preparing a child so that they get to school and they're ready to learn. We need to invest much more heavily in the early years, and that means home visiting programs, pre-K programs, and high-quality child care programs. We need to start investing more in our kids in those first few years.
Bill Jordan from New Mexico Voices for Children, many thanks for joining us today. And for more information, you can go to the group's website at nmvoices.org.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by the Academy for the Love of Learning, presenting Life is What You Make It, a thought-provoking and inspiring concert and conversation with Peter Buffett, November 7th at the Linzic Performing Arts Center. The Academy for the Love of Learning's mission is to awaken, enliven, nurture, and sustain the natural love of learning in people of all ages. More information at aloveoflearning.org.
27 minutes past the hour. The 35th Annual Southwestern Association of Forensic Scientists Conference is taking place in Santa Fe through Wednesday afternoon. A forensic scientist with the New Mexico Department of Public Safety, Fideli Nathanson, says the meeting serves training needs and provides updates on trends and technologies.
This is an opportunity for the forensic scientists in the Southwest to get together and see any trends they're seeing in controlled substances and latent prints in the DNA. The workshops are hosted and updates are given on information and new technologies. We also have vendors attending so we can see what the business community is providing for the forensic scientists and how we can get new equipment and make our labs more efficient.
Nathanson, who specializes in controlled substances, says forensic scientists nationwide have a major new concern in that area of science.
A trend that definitely across the country drug analysts are seeing are the synthetic cannabinoids, also known as spice, or the bath salts. Now, these are products sold typically at smoke shops, and they are very dangerous to the youth in across the country. There's not a lot of toxicology information about them, and we do not know what the people are putting in their body.
Nathanson says a recent news story explains why scientists are concerned.
Spice is getting to be very dangerous, and you may have heard about the person chewing off someone else's face, the case in Florida. It was not spice, but it was very suspected of spice, and it made everyone very nervous.
Another concern of forensic scientists is the popularity of TV shows, such as the CSI series, which Nathanson says creates unrealistic expectations about the work done by criminal investigators.
People watch TV, and they see the actor in an hour show find the criminal, place a vial on an instrument, and it injects, and all of a sudden you see the suspect's face on the screen and even the location of where he lives.
Nathanson says the reality of her work is more mundane.
We go in to test evidence blind, no bias. We don't even look at suspects' names. We need to just look at the facts, test unknown substances, test DNA swabs, look at fingerprints without any misleading information or public information from the news. We just have to look at the evidence.
Nathanson adds investigations take time and that there are often other delays that spring up.
We do, all our agencies have backlogs. There's a lot of crime throughout the country, and we have hundreds of cases coming in a month. And the judicial system can be slow, so that's another problem that the jurors don't understand. Most forensic scientists are not sworn officers. We don't carry guns. We don't knock down doors. We work in lab coats. And we are never in the field, typically. We are scientists only, and we try not to work with the police and have them influence our results. We are purely looking at the science.
The scientist also says the forensic science field is a growing one, offering career opportunities.
I would just like to say to, like, students out there, if you're very interested in it, the local community college, the high schools are now offering programs to take advantage of them and really know what you're getting into. Most forensic scientists are either going to have a biology or chemistry degree, or now there are actually colleges offering forensic science degrees, and they're coming across the country, so it's a great thing. And with, unfortunately, all the crimes that are increasing, we do need the field to increase.
Fideli Nathanson with the New Mexico Department of Public Safety. And that Forensic Science Conference continues through midday tomorrow at the El Dorado Hotel here in Santa Fe.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by P&M, currently providing a recycling program for old refrigerators. P&M will pick up old refrigerators for free and then safely remove the coolant so it doesn't pollute the environment. They'll recycle as much of the refrigerator as possible. If you have a question for P&M, you can talk to them on Twitter or Facebook, or visit P&M online at pnm.com.
The City of Santa Fe is offering a series of free education events for local business owners. Here now is KSFR News reporter Charles Maynard with the story.
The last few years have been challenging economically, both for families and businesses. Starting November 2nd, the City of Santa Fe is offering workshops and seminars for free to local businesses aimed at helping them to be more successful in the marketplace. Fabian Trujillo is the Economic Development Division Director for the city.
These are seminars that we've been working with SCORE for over 7 years to provide. These seminars and workshops help both existing business owners and entrepreneurs with services with different types of skills. For example, two of the ones I can give, for example, are intermediate QuickBooks and pitching your ideas to grow your businesses. These are financial workshops. They're interactive workshops, gives you hands-on training with experts. Santa Fe has mostly small business, but it's really any business. But the people that tend to go to these types of business education series are small and medium-sized businesses.
Santa Fe has a partner and valuable resource providing the lectures.
SCORE is our partner. They're the Service Corps of Retired Executives. They're a nonprofit group that's funded by the Small Business Administration. They're retired business people that they do mentoring throughout the year. They do this for businesses and entrepreneurs. They help them with basic services like business plans, financial management, marketing, and all kinds of different other types of business skills. They help businesses throughout the country grow, and we have a very active chapter here in Santa Fe, one of the best, I think the best in New Mexico. And what they do is they partner with us to put on these business education series of seminars and workshops.
There is no charge to attend any or all of these events.
They are absolutely free. The city pays for them, and they operate them along with the Santa Fe Business Incubator. There is absolutely no charge.
Reservations are needed.
The workshops, there's only 15 attendees, and the seminars, there's 40 people that can go. You can go online at www.santafescore.org, or you can register by phone by calling 424-1140 and dialing option 1, or by email, which is scoreseminars@hotmail.com.
Fabian Trujillo with the City of Santa Fe.
Workshops this year are going to be on practical accounting and budgeting, intermediate QuickBooks, and pitching your ideas to grow your business. The seminar that we're going to offer this year is understanding contracts and legal structures. We would like for you to just dial 424-1140 and come and learn some business skills and participate in a free workshop.
For KSFR News, I'm Charles Maynard.
12:34 here in the KSFR newsroom, just past the bottom of the hour, is always the right time to spend 60 seconds with our resident curmudgeon, Christopher Hagen.
Every now and then I'll watch the Travel Channel's Bizarre Foods America with host fellow Minnesotan Andrew Zimmern. The reason I only occasionally watch the show Bizarre Foods America is because it takes me a while to forget how gross the last bunch of food Zimmern put in his mouth was. This particular episode was called The Other Florida Education. In the hour-long show, our host visited families in rural north-central Florida. The people visited were self-described Florida crackers. I missed the catching and eating of frog legs. I was lucky enough to see the armadillo captured and cooked with peppers and spices, of which there aren't enough in the world to make me want to eat armadillo. And the staple of any Florida cracker diet, squirrel with gravy. I left Bizarre Foods America when host Zimmern cracked open the cooked squirrel's skull and ate its brain. At that point, my brain shut down. Or did he eat my brain, too? For KSFR, I'm Christopher Hagen.
And with that, we'll conclude today's edition of At Noon, KSFR's extended noon news hour. Dan Garrity with you here at the news desk, with many thanks to my contributing colleagues today, Tom Trowbridge and Charles Maynard. We'll be back with more news of and for New Mexico for you tomorrow, and as always, we hope you join us.